this morning is Bedell against Vannetta. Ms. Nagy.
May it please the court. Robert Earl Bedell has never wavered in his claims of innocence. The issue here is whether the jury had a reliable opportunity to assess the evidence on the identity question, notwithstanding the quantity of evidence that the prosecution suppressed. The materiality standard of United States versus Bagley controls. Under that standard, Mr. Bedell's conviction must be overturned if disclosure of the evidence suppressed by the state would have created a reasonable probability of a reasonable doubt in the mind of one or more jurors, and a reasonable probability is a probability sufficient to undermine the confidence in the outcome.
And that's the Indiana courts got it wrong when they analyzed it?
I would say so, Judge. They got it very wrong.
Now, you had two eyewitnesses who were in the gas station for several hours.
Correct.
Viewing this individual.
And then the third eyewitness who had spent a smaller amount of time with him. And then there was Mr. Hoffman, who spent a brief period of time with the perpetrator, and Vincent Carroll, who saw the perpetrator exit the building. So there were, together, six living eyewitnesses, one of whom was mentally handicapped, Joseph Harris. The state's evidence that Bedell was the killer was in only one category, as the court is starting to note, and that was the category of eyewitness identification. There was no physical evidence linking Bedell to the crime. None. The question is whether favorable evidence could reasonably be taken to put the whole case in such a different light as to undermine the confidence in the verdict. The United States Supreme Court in Kyles v. Whitley recognized a long-standing obligation of prosecutors to disclose, to seek out favorable evidence and to disclose that evidence to the defense. The state courts determined that there was no single Brady violation considered as suppressed, favorable to the defendant, and material. And the state court said that taken together, that there was a concern as to whether the state's conduct throughout the discovery process impinged on Mr. Bedell's due process rights. This is what the Indiana Court of Appeals admitted. Specifically, the state court said that the omission of Combs and Grant's information, Detective Grant, cast doubt upon whether the state provided evidence favorable to Mr. Bedell. But they said that did not rise to the level of a reversal in a post-conviction case. This is simply error in light of Kyles v. Whitley's stated duty of a prosecutor to seek out favorable evidence and turn it over to the defense. This is rooted in the prosecutor's longstanding obligation and duty to seek the truth. That's what this case is about. It's about seeking the truth. The state would like this court to rely on the case of United States versus Morris, which is a Seventh Circuit decision interpreting an alleged allegation of a Brady violation. However, that case is inapplicable in this case, in Mr. Bedell's case, because the court in Morris, as this court is well aware, determined that the agencies who were alleged to have withheld the exculpatory evidence were not part of the investigative team and were not government agents. That's a critical distinguishing factor from the Bedell case, where the police withheld evidence. The state courts also relied upon, and the state relies upon, Morris for the proposition that the due diligence of a defense attorney should somehow relieve the state of its obligation to disclose favorable evidence. Mr. Bedell asked the court not to accept that proposition. First of all, the due diligence consideration should not bar a Brady claim because the state has an absolute obligation to honor the dictates of Brady. That's clear in Kyles v. Whitley. And the prosecutor should never be placed in a position of guessing whether a piece of exculpatory evidence is discoverable by due diligence of a defendant. In other words, the state wants this court to recognize a rule that a prosecutor can be sitting with favorable evidence and be making a call as to whether the defense could obtain that evidence through an exercise of reasonable diligence, and if so, then I, the prosecutor, just will not hand it over. That is unacceptable. And that should not be the litmus for Brady v. Maryland.
Now, the two pieces of evidence you're talking about is one, this fellow said he was at the Drake Motel with your client. Is that
right.
One of them?
We've got a confidential and reliable informant who told Detective Clarence Grant that he was with Mr. Bedell at the Drake Motel on the day of the murder. And that is an alibi witness. Of course, Mr. Bedell did not know where he was on the day of the murder. He was arrested 4 months after the murder, had no idea where he was on December 5th, 1977, and was not aware of the fact that Dickie Carpenter had told Detective Clarence Grant that he was that Mr. Bedell was at the Drake Motel.
Detective Grant wasn't part of the homicide investigation, though, was he?
No. He testified at the trial in light of Aaron Jensen's testimony, because Aaron Jensen had viewed a photo book, a photo array, the day that he was robbed in the cab robbery, and picked out a photo of a gentleman by the name of Gary Taylor from the photo book. So Clarence Grant was put on the stand for the sole purpose of laying the foundation for Aaron Jensen's prior identification of another individual. By the way, Mr. Bedell's photo was contained in that photo book, and Aaron Jensen did not pick that the day of the cab robbery. The other piece of exculpatory evidence, which was highly material, is the Richard Combs investigation, where he goes to Bubba Reedus's establishment, the bootleg cab stand, and searches the walls and cannot find a bullet hole in light of the fact that Reedus told the jury in the murder case that Mr. Bedell had been in his establishment and had shot holes into his wall with a gun similar to the one used at the murder. This is valuable information because the information with regard to Combs was valuable impeachment information and also could have led to other witnesses with valuable impeachment information and could have shed some light on Bubba Reedus's motive to lie and why he was telling this lie. In terms of the first incident of exculpatory information, the alibi witness, once again, the suppression of this alibi witness caused the defense to be unable to pursue other discoverable information. And perhaps in talking to Dickie Carpenter, the defense may have come up with other alibi witnesses for Mr. Bedell. And there was also the issue relating to Reginald White, which is quite concerning. Mr. Bedell is alleging that the state intentionally manipulated this witness and told him to be quiet, told him not to tell anybody that he was at the station on the day of the murder. And interestingly, Reginald White testified that he pushed the car out of the snow or into the lot, and Robert Knapple Jr. testified in front of the grand jury that he had that the car was pushed onto the lot. That's consistent. What Reginald White said was consistent with Robert Knapple Jr. testimony to the grand jury. Also, Knapple testified at the PCR hearing that the car stalled on the lot and he pushed it. It was pushed around by the base. So there were actually two lots. So the fact that Reginald White says he pushed a car onto the lot is not really inconsistent, and this was suppressed from the defense. The most troubling is that Reginald White was in custody, and the defense obviously did not know where Reginald White was and he was selected in two lineups by Floyd Piles prior to the second trial. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Nagy. Mr. Martin.
May it please the court, this court should affirm the district court because that court correctly concluded that there was no basis for the claims raised in this habeas petition. In order to find support for any of Bedell's claims of Brady violations or ineffective assistance of counsel, because Bedell attempted essentially to characterize each due process violation as either or both, one would need to indulge a great deal of innuendo, speculation, rumor, and inconclusive accounts that were mustered at post
conviction. I'm puzzled by the way you put that. The Indiana Appellate Court itself wrote, and I'm quoting from its decision, "Moreover, the nondisclosure of a known alibi witness erodes this court's confidence in the validity of Bedell's conviction." And that's a finding by the state's appellate judiciary. Why, under Kyles, does that not require the granting of collateral relief?
Because, Your Honor, I think that the court's decision was that it was still not material.
But it can't be, right? That is the materiality finding, as the Supreme Court understands that doctrine. The state court made, apparently in Bedell's favor, the very finding that the Supreme Court says shows that the withheld evidence was material. Why don't we just say QED at that point?
Because, Your Honor,
the state court found it in his favor.
I think that the state court misspoke the basis for its finding. I think it chose.
Did you file a petition for rehearing and say, you must have miswritten here?
No, Your Honor, our office did not.
But there it is. It's just a statement by the state's appellate court, and if we take it seriously, I don't see how we avoid the conclusion that this is material. I mean, we take state court statements seriously when they favor the prosecutor. I don't see why we shouldn't take them seriously when they favor the defense.
But juxtaposed right next to that statement, Your Honor, is the statement that the court did not find that would have made a difference in the result.
Yes, we can't say that it would have changed the outcome, but that's what the Supreme Court is distinguishing. It's the former rather than the latter that is the critical finding, right? If the state judiciary was thinking that evidence is not material unless we can say that the information would have changed the outcome, that's a legal error. It's the former finding, undermining confidence in the validity of the verdict, that is the materiality finding. So you can't say the next statement shows that the first statement doesn't matter. The next statement, if it has the significance you give it, is, well, I think the magic phrase is it contradicts a decision of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Well, Your Honor,
it is. Right? What else can we do with it?
Well, Your Honor, of course, I maintain the position that the state court's decision is not a finding that evidence would have made a difference. But beyond that, although the state court did not find this, and of course then we would not be talking in terms of deference to the state court's decision, it's somewhat incomprehensible to me that it can be argued that an alibi was undiscoverable through due diligence. Presumably, Mr. Bedell would be well aware of an alibi, or at a bare minimum,
no,
Your Honor.
What he says is, as I understand it, I'm a vagrant. I don't really know where I am in any given day. They didn't arrest me till 3 months later, and I was unable, lacking the desk calendars and computer databases that you and I have, to reconstruct where I was. Maybe he's pulling our leg, but we can't assume he's pulling our leg.
Well, Your Honor, that point's well taken, but the fact of the matter is Mr. Bedell testified at post-conviction that he did run with this, he associated with this Dickie Carpenter during that time period, so he at least remembered that much. we had a period of approximately 20 years between conviction at trial and post-conviction, during which Mr. Bedell could have investigated some of his associations to try to pinpoint a little bit more accurately where he was and what he was doing at a time when he was charged with a murder. And there's no evidence produced to this effect at post-conviction, and that is not even considering the fact that the post-conviction court was entitled to credit Mr. Bedell's assertions or not, although I do not have a discrete factual finding on that, Your Honor. So, aside from the unfortunate wording of the Court of Appeals decision when it disposed of this claim, this court may de novo find that this claim, this Brady claim, was discoverable through due diligence.
De novo? When did we start making de novo factual inquiries about state criminal prosecutions in the U.S. Court of Appeals?
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I misspoke with regard to the term of art. I'm just saying that this court may find that issue legally without respect to the state court's adjudication on that. You may make that legal ruling based on the facts, because the facts that I've just related to the court are not in dispute. Moreover, it's material that Mr. Carpenter was incarcerated from 1982 until 1999, when he died, and wouldn't have been terribly difficult to locate. And also, Detective Grant didn't show any reticence to disclose these facts to Bedell's counsel during post-conviction. And I think that these facts could clearly have been discovered through due diligence. Moreover, the concerns about the state allegedly not disclosing the identity of Reginald White, who is alternatively referred to throughout the record as Pee-wee, is just a complete disregard of the way that trial counsel presented this mistaken identity defense at trial. There was ample reference to Reginald White as a suspect, and in fact, Reginald White was presented in court juxtaposed to Mr. Bedell for the jury's viewing, and also to question a witness about different lineups at which Mr. White had been presented to witnesses and when Mr. Bedell had been presented to witnesses. Trial counsel presented to the jury pictures of the lineups that contained Mr. Bedell and other suspects, discussed the investigations with the witnesses, both state's witnesses, and called his own witnesses to discuss the investigation of the other suspects. And clearly, trial counsel was well apprised of the existence of these suspects well before trial, and also elicited testimony from the witnesses on these points and made the jury aware of the fact that the police were looking at a number of suspects before the investigation narrowed to Mr. Bedell.
Did the prosecution, the prosecuting attorney, know of these the evidence coming from Detective Grant and Detective Cohen?
Your Honor, the record does not reflect that. My understanding of the record is that Mr. Beck, who was Mr. Bedell's trial counsel, his trial file, his case file was presented at post-conviction. There was no indication of that information in his file. Now, what we know from the post-conviction hearing is that Detective Grant told someone at IPD homicide that this statement had been made to him. And I think, you know, as the counsel for petitioner spoke about, that's why there's a need to show due diligence. Now, I can't refute the notion that it was suppressed, but I don't think the evidence supports that it was. However, that's not material. If there was information that would have been helpful to the defendant and he didn't get it, that's what turns the issue, not whether the prosecution knew about it.
I understand that, but for the benefit of how it was done, I think it's important.
Oh, and I appreciate that, Your Honor. And further, I think that that's why there's a need for diligence. It's something that could have been found, and sometimes mistakes are made that are not due to any nefarious bad will from the state, but mistakes nonetheless that can hurt a defendant in the presentation of his defense. And here, we do not have the diligence exercised to find this information, but the more important thing is that it wouldn't have been material in the end. And this is because of the quality and the character of the state's evidence. Petitioner paints this evidence as being very shaky, very unreliable, something that could not satisfy the court's confidence in the verdict. And this just was not the case. The two witnesses who had the best opportunity and the longest period of time to observe Mr. Bedell at the scene of the murder picked him from photographs and picked him from lineups. And they both positively ID'd him in court based on the length of time, the more than adequate lighting, the verbal exchanges with Bedell, et cetera.
Did they know him before? Had he been around this gas station before?
No, they did not know him previously, Your Honor.
And how was the mental handicap of Harris addressed? Did the jury know about that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Trial counsel, Bedell's trial counsel, conducted a lengthy series of preliminary questions to challenge Mr. Harris's competence. And Mr. Harris well showed his ability to truthfully give his account of the events and his capacity to observe and identify Mr. Bedell. You also have Mr. Knapple Jr., the victim's son, giving an identification as well. And you have those two witnesses, along with witnesses that weren't able to give positive identifications, which would have been Vincent Carroll and Floyd Piles, gave generally similar descriptions of the assailant. And it's also noteworthy that there was a similarity physically between Reginald White and Robert Bedell. But the jury was made aware of the difference in person, in court, not to mention the photographs of the lineups, et cetera, that the state presented. And I think lastly, to allay any concerns about Walter Coward as a suspect, first of all, it should be noted that trial counsel stipulated that the state had done everything it possibly could to locate and bring Coward to court. Moreover, there was testimony that Coward's appearance was dispositively dissimilar to that of Mr. Bedell, which was not as much the case with respect to Reginald White. But at any rate, the strength of the state's evidence would not have made an alibi colorable, absent a much greater showing that there was a reliable alibi, that it was specific and accurate with respect to times, places, etc., and it was Bedell's obligation, it was his burden on post-conviction review to present evidence to support that conclusion. And he did not. Finally, one last point. With respect to the testimony of Dick Reedus, also referred to alternatively as Bubba, again, this is another allegation that the state hid something when everything was out in the open before the jury. Yes, there may have been another source. There may have been another witness who could testify to the same events or the same facts in some of these cases. But trial counsel did an excellent job in this case of presenting a defense for Mr. Bedell. And this information was in front of the jury. When Mr. Reedus testified, he testified that one shot had been discharged in his establishment. And if I'm not mistaken, it was also testified to that it was inadvertent or accidental. And on cross-examination, it was elicited that Mr. Reedus, that Mr. Bedell, that police had come to search for the bullet on more than one occasion, and that this bullet had not been found. So to the extent that Detective Combs could have been presented to give the same testimony, it would have been cumulative. It would have had some, I suppose, negligible impeaching effect. But since Mr. Redis gave an accurate account in the first instance, I think negligible is probably even a generous characterization of what the impeachment effect would have been. At any rate, the allegations that the state suppressed evidence are not supported. Moreover, they were not material. Trial counsel did a more than adequate job in representing Mr. Bedell, and we believe
Thank
that
you,
this
Mr.
court
Martin.
Should affirm the district court. Thank you.
Anything further, Ms. Nagy?
Yes,
Judge. There was no similarity between Reginald White and Robert Bedell. Reginald White was very, very dark skinned. Mr. Bedell's light skinned. Mr. Bedell is 10 years older than Reginald White and lived nowhere near the station. Reginald White lived on Pennsylvania, which makes the suppression of the footprints even more important because the footprints ran all the way to Pennsylvania Street, and the defense was not told that there were prints leading to Pennsylvania Street where Reginald White lived. The state waived its challenge to the state court's findings about Richard Combs and the bullet search, and also about the information provided by Clarence Grant. The state did not challenge the state court's findings on that in its state court brief or with this court, and is now asking this court to do that. And I would ask that they not be allowed to do that. Also, the state would like for the court once again to allow due diligence of a defense attorney to have it escape its obligations under Brady v. Maryland. If the court remembers, in Kyles v. Whitley, on Reginald White, where he was shown to the jury and when Detective Highball was on the stand, the same thing happened with Beeney in Kyles v. Whitley. He was shown, there was a jury show, and Beeney did not take the stand. And nonetheless, the United States Supreme Court determined that the statements given by Beeney to the authorities were suppressed exculpatory statements, and that's exactly what happened with Reginald White, who's sitting back in the holding cell saying, I was at the station on the day of the murder. I pushed a car out of the lot on the day of the murder. And at the PCR hearing, Reginald White actually identified Edwin Kennedy's car and said he was 100% certain that that was the car that he pushed. He also was able to tell us that the prosecutor, Larry Whitney, was black. He testified that he described Robert Knappel Sr.'s appearance, the short, chubby dude. He said there was a retarded fellow at the gas station. That would be Joe Harris. These are not things that Reginald White made up or that somebody told Reginald White. This is testimony that Reginald White provided at the PCR hearing, and when he realized that I was going to accuse him then of committing the murder, he took the Fifth Amendment five times. Mr. Bedell is innocent, and Reginald White says it best when he said at the PCR hearing, I tried to tell them a whole lot of things, but they did not want to hear. And that's the same thing that's been going on in this case for 26 years. The state simply does not want to hear the fact that Mr. Bedell is innocent. And also, the witnesses who identified Mr. Bedell, and the state referenced two witnesses who picked Mr. Bedell, who had the best opportunity. I assume the state's talking about Joe Harris and Robert Knappel. Remember, this is the second trial. Knappel had identified Mr. Bedell in several lineups, or had the opportunity to identify him, saw him at the first trial. He also went through the disciplinary hearing and testified about Bedell, and Mr. Knappel Jr. changed his testimony. He recanted three prior sworn statements saying that the perpetrator wore a hat, and at the second trial testified that the perpetrator did not wear a hat. Mr. Bedell was not the perpetrator. And even Knappel at the PCR hearing admitted that he was stressed out and confused by the time of the trial. Mr. Harris clearly was not competent. He couldn't tell us how old the perpetrator was. He couldn't tell us what the perpetrator was wearing. He didn't even know what season of the year it was when Dennis Morgan, Detective Morgan, came and showed him a photo array. They asked him, when did you meet with Dennis Morgan? He didn't know where he met with Dennis Morgan. It was at the gas station. He didn't know whether it was summer, spring, fall, or winter. Mr. Harris didn't know what was going on, but one thing Mr. Harris did testify is that he ran out of the station across the alley to his home at 16th and Illinois, which is northwest of the station. So the footprints leading to Pennsylvania Street could not have belonged to Joe Harris. Joe Harris didn't live on Pennsylvania Street. The state's entire case rests upon eyewitness testimony, which is incredible. There is no physical evidence. Mr. Bedell is innocent. Reginald White tried to tell the state, and they did not listen. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Nagy, and we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case. You have the court's thanks. The case is taken under advisement.